Only in America, am I right? Look, I'm sorry it's taken so long. I'll finish the book soon, I promise. How do I say this delicately? We actually don't want the book anymore. We signed that contract in a different world. How is it different? Primarily, you're not famous anymore. We needed to strike while the iron was hot. Your iron, my friend, is ice cold. But also the country has moved on. Your quaint story about childhood love was appropriate pre-9/11, but now it's a little quiet for the times, a little incongruous, and no offense, there's nothing terribly interesting about you. Thanks. Don't take that the wrong way. It's a one in a million person who can sustain the kind of interest I specialize in. I can't possibly afford to pay that money back. It's an easy fix, dude. Foreclose on the house, hide your assets, declare bankruptcy, move to Jakarta. The intercom crackles. First-class passengers to Los Angeles can now begin boarding. Periwinkle smooths his suit. That's me, he says. He slugs the rest of his coffee and stands up. Listen, I wish things were different. I really do. I wish we didn't have to do this. If only there was something you could offer, something of interest. Samuel knows he has one thing yet to give, one thing of value. It's the only thing he has for Periwinkle. It is, right now, the only interesting thing about him. What if I told you I had a new book? Samuel says. A different book. Then I would say we had another complaint in our civil suit against you, that when you were contracted to write a book for us, you were secretly working on a book for someone else. I haven't been working on it at all, haven't written a word. Then in what way is it a book? It's not. It's more like a pitch. Do you want to hear the pitch? Sure. Fire away. It's sort of a celebrity tell-all. Okay, who's the celebrity? The Packer attacker. Yeah, right. We sent a scout. She's not talking. It's a dead end. What if I told you that she was my mother?
7.
So this is the plan. They agree to it at the airport. Samuel will fulfill his contract with the publisher by writing a book about his mother. A biography, an exposé, a tell-all. A sordid tale of sex and violence, Periwinkle says, written by the son she abandoned? Hell yeah, I could sell that. The book will describe Faye Anderson's sleazy past in the protest movement, her time as a prostitute, how she abandoned her family and went into hiding and only came out to terrorize Governor Packer. We'd have to get the book out before the election, for obvious marketing reasons, Periwinkle says, and Packer will have to come off as an American hero, a kind of folksy messiah. You okay with that? Fine. We have those pages finished already, actually. What do you mean, finished? Samuel says. The Packer stuff, ghostwritten, done, about 100 pages of it. How is that possible? You know how a lot of obituaries are written before the subjects actually die? Same principle. We've been working on a bio, just waiting for an angle, so we had it in the hopper. Half your book is ready to go, in other words. The other half is the mother material. She is, of course, cast as the villain here. You understand that, right? I do. And you can write it? You have no problems portraying her this way, morally, ethically? I will savage her intimately, publicly. That's the deal. I get it. And it will not be hard, Samuel imagines, to do this to the woman who left without a word, without warning, who left him alone to survive a motherless childhood. It's as if 2 decades worth of resentment and pain has, for the first time, found an outlet. So Samuel calls his mother's lawyer and says he's changed his mind. He says he'd be happy to write a letter to the judge in support of her case and would like to have an interview to gather key information. The lawyer gives him his mother's address in Chicago and sets up a meeting for the very next day. And Samuel is sleepless and jumpy and overstimulated all night as he imagines seeing his mother for the first time since she disappeared so long ago. It seems unfair that it's been 20 years since he's seen her and now he has only one day to prepare. How many times has he imagined it? How many fantasies of reunion has he entertained? And in the many thousands, the millions of them, what happens every time is that he proves to his mother that he is successful and smart. He is important and grown up and mature, sophisticated and happy. He shows her how extraordinary his life is, how inconsequential her absence from it has been. He shows her how much he does not need her. In his fantasies of reunion, his mother always begs his forgiveness, and he does not cry. That's how it goes every time. But how would he make this happen in real life? Samuel has no idea. He Googles it. He spends most of the night on online support boards for children of estranged parents, websites heavy in their use of capital letters and boldface type, and animated GIFs of smiley faces and frowny faces and teddy bears and angels. As he reads through these sites, the thing that surprises Samuel most is the essential sameness of everyone's problems, the intense feelings of shame and embarrassment and responsibility felt by the abandoned child, the feelings of both adoration and loathing for the missing parent, loneliness coupled with a self-defeating desire for reclusiveness, and so on. It's like looking into a mirror. All his private weaknesses come publicly back at him, and Samuel feels ashamed about this. Seeing others express exactly what's in his own heart makes him think he's unoriginal and ordinary and not the astounding man he needs to be to prove to his mother she shouldn't have left him. It's nearly 3 o'clock in the morning when he realizes he's been staring at the same animated GIF for 5 full minutes. A teddy bear giving something called a virtual hug, where the bear repeatedly opens and closes its arms in a never-ending loop that's supposed to be read as an embrace, but looks to Samuel more like a deliberate and sarcastic clap, like the bear is mocking him. He abandons the computer and sleeps fitfully for a few hours before he wakes at dawn and showers and drinks about a whole pot of coffee and gets into his car to make the drive into Chicago. Despite its proximity, Samuel rarely goes into Chicago these days, and now he remembers why. The closer he gets to the city, the more the highway feels malicious and warlike. Wild, zigzagging drivers cutting people off, tailgating, honking horns, flashing their lights, all their private traumas now publicly enlarged. Samuel travels with a crush of traffic and a slow, sluggish mass of hate. He feels that low-level, constant anxiety about not being able to get over into the turn lane when his exit is near. There's that thing where drivers next to him speed up when they see his turn signal, to eliminate the space he intended to occupy. There is no place less communal in America, no place less cooperative and brotherly, no place with fewer feelings of shared sacrifice than a rush hour freeway in Chicago. And there is no better test of this than watching what happens when there is a 100-car line in the far right lane, which there is when Samuel reaches his exit. How people bypass the line and dive into any available cranny in front, skipping all the drivers patiently waiting, all of whom are now enraged at this because they each have to wait incrementally longer, but also a bigger and deeper rage that the asshole didn't wait his turn like everyone else, that he didn't suffer like they suffer, and then also a tertiary inner rage that they are suckers who wait in lines. So they yell and gesture obscenely and hover inches from the bumper in front of them. They do not provide any gaps for cutters. They do not make way for anyone. Samuel is doing it too, and he feels if he allows just one cutter in front of him, he will let down all who wait behind. And so with each movement of the line, he guns the gas so that any space is closed. And they lurch toward the exit this way until at one point, when he is checking his mirror for possible cutters and a space opens up in front of him, and he is sure this fucking BMW coming up fast on the left is going to cut in front, Samuel is a little too careless with the accelerator and leaps forward and lightly taps the car in front of him. A taxi. The driver vaults out and screams, "Fuck you! Fuck you! Fuck you!" pointing at Samuel as if to specially emphasize that it is him and no one else who needs to be fucked. "Sorry," Samuel says, holding up his hands. The line stopping now produces a wail from the cars behind them, a squall of horns, shouts of anguish and disgust. The cutters see their opportunity and swerve in front of the stop taxi. The cabbie comes right up to Samuel's closed window and says, "I will fucking fuck you up, you fucking fuck!" And then the cabbie spits. Actually physically leans back as if to get a good running start at it, then propels forward a mucousy glob that splats terribly onto Samuel's window and sticks there. Doesn't even dribble down, but lands and sticks like pasta on a wall. This spatter, all yellowish and bubbly with flecks of chewed food and awful spots of blood in it, like one of those maybe embryos you might find in a raw egg, and satisfied with his creation, the cabbie hustles back to his car and drives away. For the rest of the drive to his mother's South Loop neighborhood, the splash of phlegm and snot is with Samuel like another passenger. It feels like he's driving with an assassin he doesn't want to make eye contact with. He can see it peripherally as a hazy, whitish, uneven penumbra as he exits the highway and proceeds down a narrow street whose gutters are dotted by the bags and cups of fast food restaurants, past a bus station and a desolate, weedy lot where it appears a high-rise was intended and abandoned immediately after its foundation was laid, over a bridge that spans the great braid of train tracks that once serviced this area's mass of slaughterhouses, just south of downtown Chicago, still in plain view of what was once the tallest building in the world, here in what was once the busiest meatpacking district in the world, to his mother's address in what turns out to be an old warehouse building near the train tracks with a giant sign on top saying, "Lofts Available." Throughout all of this, roughly a quarter of Samuel's attention remains focused on the gooey slop still sticking to his window. He has become amazed at how it doesn't budge like an epoxy made to repair broken plastic things. He is moved by the feats the human body is capable of. He's nervous about this neighborhood. There is literally nobody on the sidewalk. He parks, double-checks the address. At the building's front door, there is a buzzer. Right there, written on a slip of yellow paper and ink, now faded to a light pink, is his mother's name. Faye Anderson. He presses the buzzer, which makes no noise whatsoever and makes him think, along with the age of the contraption and the rust and the wires jutting out, that it's broken. The way his mother's button sticks for a moment before finally giving way to the pressure of his finger with an audible tick makes him think the button has not been pressed in a very long time. It strikes him that his mother has been here all along, all these years. Her name has been out here on this slip of paper, washed by the sun, for anyone to see. This does not seem allowable. It seems to Samuel that after she left, she should have ceased to exist. The door, with a heavy magnetic-sounding click, opens. He enters. The inside of the building, past the entryway and vestibule with its bank of mailboxes, seems incomplete. Tile floors that abruptly give way to subfloor. White walls that don't seem painted but rather merely primed. He climbs the three flights of stairs. He finds the door. A bare wooden door, unpainted, unfinished, like something you'd see at a hardware store. He doesn't know what he expected, but he definitely did not expect this blank nothingness. This anonymous door. He knocks. He hears a voice inside. His mother's voice. "It's open," she says. He pushes the door forward. He can see from the hall that the apartment is bright with sunlight. Bare white walls. A familiar smell he cannot place. He hesitates. He cannot immediately bring himself to walk through this door and back into his mother's life. After a moment, she speaks up again from somewhere inside. "It's okay," she says. "Don't be scared." And it nearly breaks him, hearing that. He sees her now in a rush of memory, lingering over his bed in the bleary morning, and he's 11 years old, and she's about to leave and never come back. Those words burn him straight through. They reach across the decades and summon up that timid boy he once was. "Don't be scared." It was the last thing she'd ever said to him. Part 2. Ghosts of the Old Country. Late Summer, 1988. 1. Samuel was crying in his bedroom, quietly, so his mother wouldn't hear. This was a small cry, just tiptoeing on the edge of actual crying, maybe a light whimpering along with the normal halted breathing and squished face. This was a Category 1 cry, a small, concealable, satisfying, purgative cry, usually only a welling of the eyes but lacking actual tears. A Category 2 cry was more of an emotional cry, triggered by feelings of embarrassment or shame or disappointment. This was why a Category 1 cry could be vaulted to a Category 2 simply by the presence of someone else. He felt embarrassed about crying, about being a crybaby, and this fact created a new kind of crying. That wet-faced, whimpering, snotty crying that's not yet a full-throated Category 3, which involved larger raindrop-sized tears and bouts of sniveling and convulsive breathing and a reflexive need to find a private hiding place immediately. A Category 4 was a weeping, sobbing fit, whereas Category 5 was just unthinkable. His counselor at school had encouraged him to think of his crying in these terms, using categories like they do for hurricanes. So that day he felt he needed to cry. He told his mother he was going to his room to read, which was not unusual. He spent most of his time alone in his room, reading the choose-your-own-adventure books he bought from the bookmobile at school. He liked how the books looked on the shelves all together like that, homogeneous with their white and red spines and titles like Lost on the Amazon, Journey to Stonehenge, Planet of the Dragons. He liked the books forking paths, and when he came to a particularly difficult decision, he would hold the page with his thumb and read ahead, verifying that it was an acceptable choice. The books had a clarity and symmetry to them that he found mostly absent in the real world. Sometimes he liked to imagine his life was a choose-your-own-adventure book, and that a happy story was just a matter of making the right choices. This seemed to give a structure to the sloppy and unpredictable world he found in most other contexts terrifying. So he told his mother he was reading, but really he was having a nice little Category 1. He wasn't sure why he was crying, just that something about being at home made him want to hide. The house, he thought, had lately become unbearable. The way the house seemed to trap everything inside it, the heat of the day, the smell of their own bodies. They were caught in a late summer heat wave, and everything in Illinois was melting. Everything was burning up. The air was a thick glue. Candles sagged where they stood. Flowers could not be supported by their stems. Everything wilted. Everything drooped. It was August, 1988. In the years to follow, Samuel would look back on this month as the final month he had a mother. By the end of August, she'll have disappeared. But he didn't know that yet. All he knew was that he needed to cry for certain abstract reasons. It was hot. He was worried. His mother was acting weird. So he went to his room. He was crying mostly to get it out of the way. Only she heard him. In the extreme quiet, she could hear her son crying upstairs. She opened his door and said, "Honey, are you okay?" And immediately, he cried harder. She knew in these moments not to say anything about the elevation in his crying or react to it in any way, because acknowledging it just fed the crying in a terrible feedback loop that sometimes ended on those days when he cried over and over again and she couldn't help but let her exasperation show through with a wet, blubbering, hyperventilating kid-sized mess. So she said, as soothingly as possible, "I'm hungry. Are you hungry? Let's go out, you and me." Which seemed to calm him enough to get his clothes changed and get him into the car with only minor post-crying hiccups to deal with. That is, until they got to the restaurant, she saw they were having a buy-2-get-1-free deal on hamburgers, and she said, "Oh, good, I'll get you a hamburger. You want a hamburger, right?" And Samuel, who all along had his heart set on chicken nuggets with that mustardy dipping sauce, worried that he'd disappoint her if he didn't go along with this new plan. So he nodded okay and stayed in the hot car while his mother fetched the burgers, and he tried to convince himself that he wanted a burger all along. But the more he thought about it, the more the burger seemed revolting. The stale bun and sour pickles and those uniformly cut maggot-sized onions. Even before she returned with the burgers, he was feeling a little sick and throw-uppy at the thought of having to eat one. And driving home, he was trying to contain the crying that was almost certainly coming when his mother noticed his wet, sniveling nose and said, "Sweetie, is something wrong?" And all he managed to say was, "I don't want a burger," before he was lost inside a crushing Category 3. Faye said nothing. She turned the car around while he buried his face in the hot fabric of the passenger seat and wept. Back home, they ate in silence. Samuel sat with his mother in the hot kitchen, slumped in his chair and chewing the last of his chicken pieces. The windows were open in hopes for a breeze that did not come. Fans blew hot air from here to there. They watched a housefly buzz overhead, spinning circles near the ceiling. It was the only sign of life in the room, this insect. It bumped into the wall, then the window screen, Then suddenly, unprovoked, directly above their heads, it fell. It dropped dead right out of the air and landed on the kitchen table, heavy as a marble. They looked at the small black corpse between them and then at each other. Did that really happen? Samuel's face was panicked. He was on the verge of crying again. He needed a distraction. The mother needed to intervene. "Let's go for a walk," Faye said. "Fill your wagon. Bring 9 of your favorite toys." "What?" he said, his huge, frightened eyes already slick and liquided. "Trust me, do it." "Okay," he said, and this proved an effective diversion for about 15 minutes. It felt to Faye like this was her primary duty as a mother, to create diversions. Samuel would begin to cry and she would hit it off. Why 9 toys? Because Samuel was a meticulous and organized and anal sort of kid who did things like, for example, keep a top 10 toys shoebox under his bed, mostly in the way of Star Wars action figures and Hot Wheels. He revised it occasionally, substituting one thing for another, but it was always there. At any given moment, he knew exactly what his 10 favorite toys were. So she asked him to pick 9 toys because she was mildly curious. What would he abandon? Samuel did not wonder why he was doing this. Why 9 toys? And why were they bringing them outside? No, he had been given a task, and he was going to complete it. He thought little of arbitrary rules. That he was so easily tricked made her sad. Faye yearned for him to be a little smarter, a little less easily duped. She hoped sometimes he would talk back more. She wanted him to have more fight, wanted him to be a sturdier thing. But he wasn't. He heard a rule and he followed it. Bureaucratic little robot. She watched him count his toys, trying to decide between 2 versions of the same action figure, one Luke Skywalker with binoculars and one Luke Skywalker with a lightsaber, and she thought she should be proud of him. Proud that he was such a mindful boy, such a sweet boy. But his sweetness came at a price, which was that he was delicate. He cried so easily. He was so stupidly fragile. He was like the skin of a grape. In response, she was sometimes too hard on him. She did not like how he went through life so scared of everything. She did not like to see her own failures reflected back at her so clearly. "I'm done, Mama," he said, and she counted 8 toys in his wagon. He had left behind both Luke Skywalkers, it turned out, but only 8 toys, not 9. He hadn't followed her one simple instruction, and now she didn't know what she wanted of him. She was angry when he blindly obeyed, but now also angry that he didn't obey better. She felt unhinged. "Let's go," she said. Outside, it was unimaginably still and sticky. No movement except the heat ripples coming off roofs and asphalt. They walked down the wide street that curved through their particular subdivision and branched occasionally into stubby cul-de-sacs. Ahead of them, the neighborhood was all crunchy yellow grass and garage doors and houses following identical plans. Front door set way back, garage door pushed way forward, as if the house were trying to hide behind it. Those smooth, beige, faceless garage doors, they seemed to capture something essential about the place, something about the suburb's loneliness, she thought. A big front porch brings you out into the world, but a garage door shuts you off from it. How had she ended up here? Of all places. Her husband, that's how. Henry had moved them to the house on Oakdale Lane in this little city of Streamwood, one of Chicago's many indistinct suburbs. This after a string of small 2-bedroom apartments in various Midwestern agro-industrial outposts, as Henry climbed the corporate ladder in his chosen field, pre-packaged frozen meals. When they landed in Streamwood, Henry insisted it was their final move, scoring as he had a job good enough to stay for. Associate Vice President of R&D, Frozen Foods Division. The day they moved in, Faye said, "I guess this is it," then turned to Samuel. "I guess this is where you're going to be from." Streamwood, she thought now. No streams, no woods. "The thing about garage doors," she said, and she turned around to find Samuel staring at the asphalt in front of him, concentrating hard on something. He hadn't heard her. "Never mind," she said. Samuel pulled the wagon, and its plastic wheels clacked on the street. Sometimes a pebble would lodge under one of the wheels, and the wagon would stop moving, and the jolt would almost knock him down. He felt, whenever this happened, like he was disappointing his mother. So he watched for any kind of debris and kicked away stones and pieces of mulch and bark. And when he kicked, he was careful not to kick very hard for fear his shoe would get stubbed in a sidewalk crack, and he'd go tumbling forward, tripping on nothing, just walking wrong, which he worried would also disappoint his mother. He was trying to keep up with her, since she might be disappointed if he fell behind, and she had to wait for him. But he couldn't go so fast that one of his 8 toys might topple out of the wagon, which would be a clumsy thing she definitely would be disappointed by. So he had to achieve exactly the right pace to keep up with his mother, but then slow down on the parts of the street that were cracked and uneven, and watch for debris and kick debris away without tripping, and if he could do all of this successfully, then it might be a better day. He might salvage the day. He might be less of a disappointment. He might erase what happened earlier, which is that he was a giant, stupid crybaby again. He felt bad about this now. He felt that he certainly could have eaten the burger, that he just psyched himself out, and if he would have given it a chance, he was sure the burger would have been a perfectly acceptable dinner. He felt guilty about the whole thing. The way his mother turned the car around and fetched him chicken nuggets seemed to him now so heroic and good. Good in a way he never could be. He felt selfish, the way his crying let him get whatever he wanted, even though that was not his intention at all. And he was trying to figure out a way to tell his mother that if it were up to him, he'd never cry again, and she'd never have to spend hours calming him down or pandering to his inconsiderate and thoughtless needs. He wanted to say this. He was getting the words right in his head. His mother, meanwhile, was looking at the trees. One of the neighbor's front yard oaks, like everything else, it was drooping and desiccated and sad, its branches listing to the ground. Leaves not really green, but a scorched amber. There was no sound at all. No wind chimes, no birds, dogs were not barking. Children were not laughing. His mother looked up at this tree. Samuel stopped and looked too. She said, "Do you see it?" Samuel didn't know what he was supposed to be seeing.
"The tree?" he said.
"Up near the top branch, see?" she pointed. "All the way up, that leaf." He followed her finger and saw a single leaf that did not look quite like the others. It was green, thick, it stood straight up, and it was flopping around like a fish, twisting as if there were a swirling wind. It was the only leaf on the tree that was doing this. The rest hung quietly in the dead air. There was no wind on the block, and yet this leaf was a maniac. "Do you know what that is?" she said. "It's a ghost."
"It is?"
he said. "That leaf is haunted." "A leaf can be haunted?"
"Anything can be haunted. A ghost can live in a leaf as well as anywhere else."
He watched the leaf spin around as if it were attached to a kite.
"Why is it doing that?" he said.
"That's the spirit of a person," she said. "My father told me about this. One of his old stories from Norway, from when he was a kid. It's someone not good enough to go to heaven, but not bad enough to go to hell. He's in between."
Samuel had not considered this a possibility.
"He's restless," she said. "He wants to move on. Maybe he was a good person who did one really bad thing. Or maybe he did lots of bad things but felt very sorry about them. Maybe he didn't want to do bad things, but he couldn't stop himself." And at this, once again, Samuel cried. He felt his face crumple. The tears came so unstoppably quickly, because he knew he did bad things over and over and over. Faye noticed and closed her eyes and rubbed her fingers hard at her temples and covered her face with her hand. He could tell this was about as much as she could tolerate today, how she'd met the limits of her patience, how the crying about bad things was itself another bad thing.
"Sweetheart," she said, "why are you crying?"
He still wanted to tell her that what he desired more than anything else in the world was to stop crying, but he couldn't say it. All he managed to do was to spit out something incoherent through the tears and mucus.
"I don't want to be a leaf."
"Why on earth would you think that?" she said. She took his hand and pulled him home, and the only sound on the whole block was the clacking of the wagon wheels and his whimpering. She took him to his room and told him to put his toys away. "And I told you to bring 9 toys," she said. "You brought 8. Next time try to pay more attention." And the disappointment in her voice made him cry even harder. So hard that he couldn't talk.
and thus he couldn't tell her that he put 8 toys in the wagon, because the 9th toy was the wagon itself. 2. Samuel's father insisted that Sunday evenings be devoted to family time, and they'd have a mandatory dinner together, all of them sitting around the table while Henry tried valiantly to make conversation. They'd eat some of the packaged meals from his special office freezer, where the experimental and test market foods were kept. These were usually more daring, more exotic, mango instead of baked apples, sweet potatoes instead of regular potatoes, sweet and sour pork instead of pork chops, or things that would not at first glance seem ideal for freezing, lobster rolls, say, or grilled cheese, or tuna melts. "You know, the interesting thing about frozen meals," Henry said, "is that they weren't popular until Swanson decided to call them TV dinners. Frozen meals had been around for a decade when they changed the name to TV dinner, and boom, sales exploded." "Mm-hmm," Faye said as she stared straight down into her chicken cordon bleu. "It's like people needed permission to eat in front of the television, you know? It's like everyone wanted to eat in front of the TV already, but they were waiting for someone to endorse it." "That's super fascinating," Faye said in a tone that made him shut right up. Then more silence before Henry asked what the family wanted to do tonight, and Faye suggesting he just go watch TV. And Henry asking if she wanted to join him, and Faye saying no, she had dishes to put away and cleaning to do, and you should go on ahead, and Henry asking if she needed his help with the cleaning, and Faye saying no, he'd just get in the way, and Henry suggesting that maybe she should relax and he'd do the cleanup tonight, and Faye getting frustrated and standing up and saying, "You don't even know where anything goes," and Henry looking at her hard and seeming like he was on the verge of saying something, but then ultimately not saying it. Samuel thought how his father married to his mother was like a spoon married to a garbage disposal. "May I be excused?" Samuel said. Henry looked at him, wounded. "It's family night," he said. "You're excused," Faye said, and Samuel leaped off the chair and scurried outside. He felt that familiar desire to go hide. He felt this way whenever the tension in the house seemed to gather up inside him. He hid in the woods, a tiny patch of woods that grew along a sad creek that ran behind their subdivision. A few short trees sprouting out of the mud, a pond that was at best waist-deep, a creek that collected all the subdivision's runoff so the water had this colorful, oily film after it rained. It was really pathetic, these woods, as far as nature goes, but the trees were thick enough to conceal him. When he was down here, he was invisible. If anyone asked him what he was doing, he'd say playing, which didn't quite capture it. Could it really be called playing when he only sat there in the grass and mud and hid in the leaves and threw helicopter seeds into the air and watched them spin to the ground? It was Samuel's intention to come down to the creek and hide for a couple of hours, at least until bedtime. And he was searching for a spot, a convenient depression in the ground that would give him maximum coverage. A spot where, if he put a few dead branches over him, a few leaves, he would be hidden. And he was collecting the twigs and branches he'd used to cover himself, and he was beneath this one particular oak tree, digging among the dead leaves and acorns on the ground, when something cracked above him. A snapping of branches, a creaking of the tree, and he looked up in time to see someone jump down from the tree and land hard on the ground behind him. A boy, no older than Samuel, who stood up and stared fiercely at him with eyes sharp and green and almost feline. He was not larger than Samuel, nor taller, nor in any way physically special except in the certain intangible way he filled up space. His body had a presence. He stepped closer. His face was thin and angular and smeared on his cheeks and forehead with blood. Samuel dropped his twigs. He wanted to run. He told himself to run. The boy moved closer, and from behind his back he now produced a knife, a heavy silver butcher's knife, the kind Samuel had seen his mother use when chopping things with bones. Samuel began to cry, just stood there crying, rooted to the ground, waiting for whatever his fate was, succumbing to it. He vaulted right into a Category 3 slobbering, wet, helpless mess. He could feel his face constrict and his eyes bug out as if his skin were being stretched from behind,
and the other boy stood directly before him now, and Samuel could see the blood from close up, could see how it was still wet and shining in the sunlight, and one drop dribbled down the boy's cheek and under his chin and down his neck and under his shirt, and Samuel didn't even wonder where the blood came from, so much as simply wail at the horrible fact of its presence. The boy had short reddish hair, eyes that seemed impenetrable and dead, freckles, something like an athlete's sense of bodily control and self-possession and fluidity of movement as he slowly brought the knife over his head in the universal language for psychopathic murderous stabbing.
"This is what we call a successful ambush," the kid said. "If we were at war, you'd be dead right now."
And the cry Samuel let out summoned all his misery and channeled it in one wail, a great, sad scream for help.
"Holy shit," the kid said.
"You are ugly when you're crying." He lowered the knife.
"What's all right? Look, just kidding."
But Samuel could not stop. The hysteria kept rolling over him.
"It's okay," the kid said. "No problem. You don't have to talk."
Samuel wiped his arm across his nose and came away with a long, slick streak.
"Come with me," kid said. "I want to show you something."
He led Samuel to the creek and then along the bank for several yards until he came to a place near the pond where a tree had tipped over, leaving a large depression between the roots and the earth.
"Look,"
the kid said. He pointed to a spot where he'd smoothed out all the mud into a makeshift bowl, and inside the bowl were several animals, a few frogs, a snake, a fish.
"You see them?"
he said. Samuel nodded. The snake, he could see now, was missing its head. The frogs had been slit open at the belly or stabbed in the back. There must have been 8 or 9 of them, all dead save for one, whose legs kicked, bicycling in the air. The fish were beheaded at the gills. They all rested in a bloody slime that gathered at the bottom of the bowl.
"I'm thinking about blowtorching them," the kid said. "You know, with insect spray and a lighter?"
He pantomimed this, flicking the lighter, holding the spray up to it.
"Sit down," he said.
Samuel did as he was told, and the boy reached 2 fingers into the blood.
"We're going to have to toughen you up," he said.
He smeared the blood on Samuel's face, 2 streaks under his eyes and 1 on his forehead.
"There," he said. "Now you're initiated."
He stabbed the knife into the mud so it stood straight up.
"Now you're really alive."
3. The sun was setting, the day's heat lifting, mosquitoes buzzing forth in squadrons from the woods as 2 boys emerged from the tree line, muddy and wet. They'd been walking across terrain Samuel had never seen before, taking him away from his own neighborhood and into this other one, Venetian Village, it was called. The boys' faces were shiny and moist from where they'd used pond water to clean off the smears of animal blood. Though they were the same height and the same age and roughly the same build, which is to say short and 11 years old and tightly skinny, like ropes pulled to maximum tolerances, it was obvious to anyone seeing them that one of the boys was in charge. His name was Bishop Fall. He was the tree leaper, the ambusher, the animal killer. He was explaining to Samuel how he would someday be a 5-star general in the United States Army.
"Duty, honor, country," he said, "taking the fight to the enemy. That's my motto."
"What fight?" said Samuel, who was looking around at the houses of Venetian Village, houses larger than any he had ever seen.
"Whatever fight there is," Bishop said. "Hoo-ah!"
He was going to join the army as an officer after military college, then become a major, then a colonel, then finally someday a 5-star general.
"A 5-star general has a higher security clearance than a president," Bishop said. "I'm going to know all the secrets."
"Will you tell me?" Samuel said.
"No, they're classified."
"But I won't tell anyone."
"National security, sorry."
"Please?
No way."
Samuel nodded. "You're going to be good at this." It turned out that Bishop would be joining Samuel in the 6th grade class at the local public elementary school, having been recently expelled from his private school, Blessed Heart Academy, for, he said, not taking any shit. By which he meant listening to AC/DC on his Walkman and telling one of the nuns to fuck off and getting into fights with anyone who was willing, even high schoolers, even priests.
Blessed Heart Academy was a Catholic K-12 prep school that was really the only local option if you wanted your kid to go to one of the elite East Coast universities. All of the parents of Venetian Village sent their children there. Samuel had never been in Venetian Village before, but sometimes on his longer bike rides he passed the front gate, which was copper and 10 feet tall. The homes here were large Roman-style villas with flat roofs of terracotta tile, circular driveways curving around dramatic fountains. Houses were separated from each other by a distance at least as great as a soccer field, a swimming pool in every backyard, exotic sports cars in the driveways, or golf carts, or both. Samuel imagined who could possibly live here, television stars, professional baseball players. But Bishop said it was mostly boring office people.
"That guy," Bishop said, pointing to one of the villas, "owns an insurance company. That one," he said, pointing to another, "he runs a bank or something."
Venetian Village had 19 single-family units, each of them a standardized 3 stories with 6 bedrooms, 4 full baths, 3 powder rooms, marble kitchen countertops, 500-bottle wine cellar, private interior elevator, tornado-grade impact glass, exercise room, 4-car garage, all of them an identical 5,295 square feet that, due to a specially treated glue used in construction, smelled lightly of cinnamon. The exact sameness of the houses was actually a selling point for families worried about not having the nicest house on the block. Realtors often said that in Venetian Village you didn't have to keep up with the Joneses, even though every family who lived in Venetian Village had been the Joneses in whatever neighborhood they'd come from. And hierarchies quietly emerged in other ways. Various backyard additions of gazebos or screened-in 2-story lanais, or even a lit hard-true clay surface tennis court. Each house was built from exactly the same mold but was uniquely accessorized. A backyard saltwater hot tub, for example, behind one of the villas that Bishop stopped in front of. "This is where the headmaster of Blessed Heart lives," Bishop said. "He's a fat fuck." He made a show of grabbing his crotch and flipping his middle finger at the house, then grabbed a small rock that lay in the gutter. "Watch this," he said, and he flung the rock toward the headmaster's house. It seemed to happen before either of them could even think about it. Suddenly this rock was in the air and they watched it fly and everything seemed to slow down for a moment as both boys realized that the rock was definitely going to hit the house and there was nothing they could do about this fact. The rock flew through the red-orange sky and it was only a matter of gravity now and time. The rock arced downward and narrowly missed the forest green Jaguar in the headmaster's driveway, striking the aluminum garage just beyond the Jaguar with a percussive, reverberative thunk. The boys looked at each other in elation and terror, the sound of rock on garage doors seeming to them the loudest thing in the world.
"Holy shit!"
said Bishop, and both of them, as if moved by the natural impulses of hunted animals, ran. They ran down Via Veneto, the neighborhood's lone street, which followed roughly the same curvature as a path that deer had made when this place was still a nature preserve, a path that ran between the small man-made ponds of the north and a large drainage ditch to the south, these 2 bodies of water being enough to sustain a modest deer population even through the Illinois winter, a herd whose offspring still lingered in Venetian Village and terrorized various carefully tended flowering plants and gardens. The deer were so annoying that the residents of Venetian Village paid quarterly fees to a deer exterminator who left salt licks laced with poison on posts high enough for adult deer to reach, but importantly too high for any of the neighborhood's 25-pound and under dogs to accidentally ingest. The poison was not immediate, but rather bioaccumulated in the deer's body, so that when the animal's death instincts kicked in, it tended to wander far away from its herd and die, conveniently, somewhere else. And so, along with the standardized gondolier-themed mailboxes and front yard water features, Venetian Village's other major repeating architectural items were posts with salt licks on them and signs saying danger, poison, keep away, in a very tactful and elegant serif typeface that could also be found on the Venetian Village official stationery. The neighborhood should have never existed, but for a loophole that was exploited by 3 Chicago investors. Before Venetian Village, there was the Milkweed Nature Preserve, named after the plant that grew in great abundance here and
drew huge numbers of monarch butterflies in the summer. The city was looking for a private organization, preferably non-profit and or charitable, to tend the preserve in its various paths in general health and biodiversity. The covenants the city drafted stated that the buyer of the land could not develop the land, nor could the buyer sell the land to anyone who would develop it. But the agreement said nothing about whom that buyer, i.e. the second one, could sell the land to. So one of the business partners bought the land, then sold it to another of the partners, who quickly sold it to the third partner, who immediately formed an LLC with the other two guys and went to work knocking down the forest. They installed a thick copper fence around what was once the Milkweed Nature Preserve and advertised to high-end Sotheby's-style clients, one of their catchphrases being, "The intersection of luxury and nature." One of the three founding partners still lived in Venetian Village, a commodities trader with offices at both the Chicago Stock Exchange and Wall Street. His name was Gerald Fall. He was Bishop's father. Gerald Fall, the only person on the block, save for the two boys themselves, who saw the stones strike the headmaster's house, who watched as Bishop and Samuel ran down the soft slope of the road toward the low end of Via Veneto's terminating cul-de-sac, where he was standing in the driveway, the door of his black BMW open, his right foot already in the car, his left foot still on the driveway he'd had expensively done in high-gloss cobblestone. He was leaving when he spotted his son throw the rock at the headmaster's house. The boys did not see him there until they were upon the driveway themselves, where they squeaked to a halt on the polished stone, the sound like basketball players on a gym floor. Bishop and his father considered each other for a moment. "The headmaster's sick," the father said. "Why are you bothering him?" "Sorry," said Bishop. "He's very ill. He's a sick man." "I know." "What if he's sleeping and you just ruined it?" "I'll be sure to apologize."
"You do that."
"Where are you going?" Bishop asked.
"The airport. I'll be at the New York apartment for a while."
"Again?"
"Don't bother your sister while I'm gone."
He looked at the boy's feet, wet and dirty from the woods.
"And don't track mud in the house."
With that, Bishop's father dove fully into his car and shut the door hard, and the engine purred to life, and the BMW circled out of the driveway, its tires making this noise on the smooth stones like something screaming. Inside, the Fall household had a formality that made Samuel not want to touch anything. Bright white stone floors, chandeliers with crystal things hanging off of them. Flowers in tall and thin and easily tippable glass vases. Framed abstract artwork on the walls lit by recessed bulbs. A thick wooden display hutch with about 24 snow globes inside it. The tops of tables buffed to a mirror-like clarity. Kitchen counters of white marble similarly shined, each room and hallway defined by a wide arch set atop Corinthian columns that were so intricately detailed at the top they looked like muskets that had backfired and been torn apart.
"This way," Bishop said.
He led them to a room that could only be called the TV room, for the big screen television that Samuel felt dwarfed by. It was taller than he was and wider than his own wingspan. Below the television were strewn various cords and wires for video game consoles stacked clumsily in a small cabinet. Game cartridges lay haphazardly about them like spent artillery shells.
"Do you like Metroid or Castlevania or Super Mario?"
Bishop said.
"I don't know. I can save the princess in Super Mario without even dying. I've also beaten Mega Man, Double Dragon, and Kid Icarus."
"It doesn't matter what we play."
"Yeah, that's true. They're all pretty much the same game, same basic premise. Go right."
He reached into the cabinet and produced an Atari all tangled in its own cords.
"I actually prefer the classics," he said. "Games made before all the cliches were established. Galaga, Donkey Kong, or Joust is one of my favorites, even though it's weird."
"I've never played it."
"Yeah, it's pretty weird. Ostriches and stuff, pterodactyls. There's also Centipede and Pac-Man. You've played Pac-Man, right?"
"Yes. Pretty fucking amazing, isn't it? Here's one." Bishop grabbed a cartridge called Missile Command and jammed it into the Atari.
"You watch me first, then you'll know how to play."
The point of Missile Command was to protect six cities from a ceaseless hail of ICBMs. When a missile landed on one of the six cities, it did so with an ugly, plosive noise and a little splash that was probably supposed to be a mushroom cloud, but looked more like a
small pebble or a frog breaking the surface of a still pond. The game's soundtrack was mostly an 8-bit digital conversion of an air raid horn. Bishop positioned his targeting reticule out in front of the incoming missiles and pressed his button, and a small trace of light shot up from the ground and slowly climbed to the targeted spot, where it collided with a falling nuke. Bishop didn't even lose a city until around level 9. Samuel lost track of levels eventually, so by the time the sky was packed with missile trails falling fast and thick, he had no idea how many boards had been conquered. Bishop's face through all of this was utterly calm and fish-like and blank. "Want to see me do it again?" Bishop said as the screen flashed, "Game over."
"Did you win?"
"What do you mean, win?"
"Did you save all the cities?"
"You can't save all the cities."
"So what's the point?"
"Annihilation is inevitable. The point is delaying it."
"So people can escape?"
"Sure, whatever."
"Do it again." And so Bishop was on to level 6 or 7 in his second game, and Samuel was watching Bishop's face instead of the game. How his face was so focused and undisturbed, even while missiles crashed down around his cities, even while his hands jerked the controller this way and that, when, from outside the room, Samuel heard something else. Something new. It was music. Clean and clear, and not at all like the scratchy and digitized sounds currently coming out of the television. Musical scales, a solo string instrument going up and down a scale.
"What's that?"
"That's my sister," Bishop said. "Bethany. She's practicing."
"Practicing what?"
"Violin. She's going to be a world-famous violinist. She's really outstandingly good."
"I'll say,"
Samuel blurted out, maybe too enthusiastically, a bit out of proportion to the actual conversation. But he wanted Bishop to like him. He was trying to be agreeable. Bishop gave him a brief and curious look before steering forward again, blankly, onward to levels 10 and 11, while the music outside changed from a basic scale to real, actual music, a soaring and densely noted solo that Samuel could not believe was coming from a person and not the radio.
"That's really your sister?"
"Yep."
"I want to see," Samuel said.
"Wait, watch this,"
Bishop said as he annihilated two nukes at the same time with one shot.
"Just for one second," Samuel said. "But I haven't even lost a city yet. This could be the highest scoring game of Missile Command ever. You could be watching something historic."
"I'll be right back."
"Fine," Bishop said. "Your loss."
And Samuel left to find the source of the music. He followed the sounds through the main vaulted hallway, through the gleaming kitchen into the back of the house, to an office where he slowly wrapped his nose around the frame of the door and peeked inside and saw, for the first time, Bishop's sister. They were twins. Bethany had Bishop's face, the same checkmark eyebrows, the same quiet intensity. She looked like an elven princess on the cover of a choose-your-own-adventure novel, immortally young and beautiful and wise. The sharp angles of her cheeks and nose fit her better than they did Bishop. Whereas Bishop looked angry, she looked stately, statuesque. Her long and thick auburn hair, thin eyebrows crinkled in concentration, long neck and delicate arms and erect posture, and the careful way she sat in a skirt, a kind of propriety and elegance and ladylike maturity that just killed Samuel. He loved the way she moved with her violin, the way the whole apparatus of her head and neck and torso seemed to glide with the movements of her bow. This was in sharp contrast to the kids in his school's orchestra, who forced sound out of their instruments mechanically and abusively. Her playing was so effortless. He didn't know it then, but this would become his template for beauty for the rest of his life. Any girl he ever met from now on would be compared, in his head, to this girl. She finished on a long note where she did that amazing thing where the bow kept moving back and forth and yet there was no break at all, just a prolonged liquid sound. And she opened her eyes and looked directly at him. And they stared at each other for a terrifying moment until she brought the violin down into her lap and said, "Hi there." Samuel had never felt such uncomfortable longings before. This was the first time his body tingled like this.
Cold sweat gummed up his armpits. His mouth suddenly seemed too small, his tongue all of a sudden huge and arid, a panicky sensation in his lungs as if he'd been holding his breath for too long. All of these things coalesced in his body as a kind of hyper-awareness, a strange magnetic pull toward the object of his fancy that departed significantly from the way he tried to ignore or hide from most people. The girl waited for him to say something, her hands in her lap, resting on her violin, her ankles crossed, those penetrating green eyes. "I'm Bishop's friend," Samuel finally said. "I'm here with Bishop."
"Okay."
"Your brother?" She smiled.
"Yes, I know."
"I heard you practicing. What are you practicing for?"
She looked at him quizzically for a moment.
"To get the notes under my fingers," she said. "I have a concert coming up. What did you think?"
"It was beautiful."
She nodded and seemed to consider this.
"The double stops in the third movement are really hard to play in tune," she said.
"Uh-huh."
"And the arpeggios on the third page are rough. Plus, I have to play in tenths, which is weird."
"Yes."
"I feel like I'm falling all over at that third movement, stumbling the whole way."
"It didn't sound like that."
"It's like I'm a bird stapled to a chair."
"Right," Samuel said. He was not comfortable with this topic at all.
"I need to relax," she said. "Especially in the second movement. There are these long melodic lines in the second movement, and if you play them with too much gusto, it ruins the musicality of the whole piece. You have to be calm and serene, which is the last thing your body wants when you're playing a solo."
"Maybe you can, I don't know, breathe?"
Samuel said, because that's what his mother told him during his uncontrollable Category 4s. "Just breathe."
"You know what works?" she said.
"I imagine my bow is a knife." She held it up, the bow, and pointed it at him with false menace. "And then I imagine the violin is a stick of butter. Then I pretend I'm drawing the knife through the butter. It should feel like that."
Samuel just nodded, helpless.
"How do you know my brother?" she said.
"He jumped out of a tree and scared me."
"Oh,"
she said, as if this made perfect sense.
"He's playing Missile Command right now, isn't he?"
"How'd you know that?"
"He's my brother. I can feel it."
"Really?" She held his stare for a moment, then giggled.
"No, I can hear it."
"Hear what?"
"The game. Listen, can't you hear it?"
"I don't hear anything."
"You have to concentrate. Just listen. Close your eyes and listen."
And so he did, and he began to hear the various sounds of the house separate themselves, break from one buzzy collective hum into individual details. The air conditioner working somewhere within the walls, the whoosh of air through vents, the wind outside brushing against the house, the refrigerator and freezer, and Samuel recognized these things and pushed them out of the way and felt his concentration extend back into the house and snake from room to room until all at once there it was, popping out of the silence, the faint and muffled air raid sirens, missile explosions, the pew-pew sounds of rockets fired.
"I hear it," he said.
But when he opened his eyes, Bethany was no longer looking at him. She had her face turned away toward the big window that looked out onto the backyard and the forest beyond. Samuel followed her stare and saw outside, through the twilight, at the tree line, maybe 50 feet away, a large adult deer. Light brown and spotted, big black animal eyes, and as the animal moved, it hobbled and staggered, fell down and recovered and got up again and kept going, swaying and bucking just to move.
"What's wrong with it?" Samuel said.
"It's eaten the salt."
The deer's front legs gave out again, and it pushed itself along on its belly. Then it recovered momentarily, only to twist and crane its neck so that it could move only in circles. Its eyes were wide and panicked. A pink foam dripped from its nose.
"This happens all the time," Bethany said.
The deer turned toward the forest and made its way into the trees. They watched it go, tumbling forward, until they could no longer see it through the foliage. Then all was quiet except for the faint sounds from the other end of the house. Bombs dropping out of the sky and flattening whole cities. 4. As the school year began, this new thing started happening.
Samuel would be sitting in class and taking faithful and meticulous notes about whatever Miss Bowles was teaching that moment, American history, multiplication, grammar, and sincerely thinking about the material and really trying to understand it and worrying that Miss Bowles could at any moment call on him and ask him pop quiz questions about the material she'd just covered, which she often did, mocking those kids who answered incorrectly, suggesting for the next hour or so that perhaps they belonged in fifth grade rather than sixth, and Samuel paying attention closely and carefully and absolutely not letting his mind wander and not thinking about girls or doing anything regarding girls, and yet this thing happened. It began as a kind of warmth, a tingle, like that feeling when someone is about to tickle you, that terrible anticipation. Then a sudden awareness of a body part that up until now was obscured, was among all those feelings that happened beneath what he paid attention to. The fabric on his shoulders, the fit of his socks, what his elbow was at any moment touching. Most of the time the body fades away, but lately, for no reason, more frequently than Samuel would like, his prick had become assertive. In class, at his desk, it would announce itself. It pushed against his jeans and then against the unforgiving metal underside of the school's one-size-fits-all desk. And the problem here was that all this rising and swelling and pressing was mortifying, but also in a purely physical way, it was really pleasant. He wanted it to go away, but then again, he also didn't. Did Miss Bowles know? Could she see it? That daily some of her boys went starry-eyed and glassy as their nervous systems took them somewhere else? If she did, she didn't say anything. And she never called on any of the boys in such a state and demanded they stand while giving their answers. This seemed, for Miss Bowles, unusually merciful. Samuel looked at the clock. 10 minutes till recess. His pants felt too tight. He felt wedged into his seat. Then his mind flashed involuntarily with visions of girls, his mental inventory of images accidentally caught here and there, cleavage seam when a woman at the mall bent over, a snip of leg and crotch and inner thigh glimpsed as girls in class.